Kick it!
Welcome to Best Picture This, where it is always Oscar season. I'm Mike.
And I'm Brian. In this show, we reevaluate every Best Picture nominee from the 21st century and decide whether to keep it or kick it from its Oscar pedestal.
But you should be afraid, Brian, very afraid, because today we're breaking the mold. We are teleporting out of our series on the films of 2002 and into a special patron-chosen bonus episode on David Cronenberg's 1986 body horror film, The Fly. Let's watch the trailer.
I think you're making a mistake. I think you really want to talk to me.
Sorry, I have three other interviews to do before this party's over.
Yeah, but they're not working on something that'll change the world as we know it.
They say they are.
Yeah, but they're lying.
There is a limit, even to the imagination.
Human teleportation, molecular decimation, breakdown, and reformation is inherently purging.
Where our greatest creations meet our deepest fears.
Something went wrong, Seth. When you went through, something went wrong.
You are about to go beyond that limit.
Those weird hairs that were growing out of your back, I had them analyzed. But they were definitely not human.
If you saw how scared and angry and desperate he is...
I'm sure Typhoid Mary was a very nice person, too, when you saw her socially.
No!
You're afraid to be destroyed and recreated, aren't you?
You're changing, Seth. Everything about you is changing.
Oh, no. What's happening to me? Am I dying?
I want to know what's going on.
What does the disease want?
It wants to turn me into something else.
Oh, no.
A fly got into the transmitter pod with me that first time when I was alone.
Don't go back to it.
Could be contagious.
I'm afraid!
Don't be afraid!
No. Be afraid. Be very afraid.
Help me. Please, help me.
A good horror trailer.
Same voice as the guy who did the Taxi Driver trailer, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
The Fly was nominated for one Oscar, Best Makeup. It was also taken seriously enough that it was in the top 10 films of the year by the National Board of Review, which often includes a lot of crossover movies with the Oscars. So I have a quick, question to start out with, but have you seen also The Fly as an opera?
No.
Did you catch that one?
I'd be down, but I haven't seen it.
It got bad reviews, but it did happen in 2008. So you probably missed it. But
was this on Broadway?
I don't know. I think so. But there, there's three characters basically. There's these dramatic feelings. So maybe it was not a bad choice for an opera,
I love it.
So coming up on the show today, we are going to give our Farley Awards. For the most awesome moment of the movie, we'll do our golden takes. We'll ask each other one question designed to pluck the back hairs of truth for analysis. And we will imagine what might have been, and we'll talk some trivia.
But first, like I said before, this is a patron-chosen episode. So thanks to Chris from Tampa for sponsoring this one. And if you want to choose an episode of your own to be featured on a future episode of the show, all you have to do is head over to patreon.com/bestpicturethis and become a patron. For $5 a month, you can curate a feature of your own. Plus, we'll recognize you on the show. But let's get into the Farley Awards. That's for our most awesome moment of the movie. And for me, there's so much about Goldblum's performance in the opening scene that I love. How he plays it with this mix of aloof, charming, also sinister, so much so that we're really not sure what to make of him. He's wild-eyed, and there's so much ambiguity there that will pay off, further down the line in the movie. But you don't know when he brings Gina Davis to his apartment to see his teleportation pods. He says something like, "Now that you've seen it, I can't let you leave here alive." And we don't know if he's actually dangerous or not. And I think that's so much of why this movie works, because it kind of rides that line. But I say all that because I didn't want to jump right to the end of the movie without crediting a lot of the setup that makes it work, you know, here at the top of the show. Because my best moment, Brian, really, is the climax, the very, very end. Mm-hmm. We're in the lab. Goldblum's human body is completely falling away.
So this is basically another awesome moment.
Saying that this moment is partly so awesome because of
the setup.
Okay, the setup. And also, can we really start the show by talking about the last 2 minutes of the movie? I mean, that seems a little cheap, right? Mm-hmm. There's got to be some setup. But Goldblum's body is falling away, and he's trying to pull Gina Davis into a pod so that they can merge bodies and become one. You have the fog. You have the dramatic monster movie music. And it's so intense. And the makeup 35 years later totally holds up. But I want to talk about how it ends. You know, once we reach that apex, you know, of emotion, Goldblum is like devolved. He's merged. He's like half machinery, half fly. And he holds the shotgun to his head for Davis to pull the trigger, you know. Movie, this is the last three things. Shotgun blast. Gina Davis wailing on the floor. Credits roll. And I just think that that is the perfect way to end a horror movie. Because after a sequence like that, you want to sit in it a little bit afterwards. And I think that so many horror movies make the mistake of kind of showing us an epilogue where things have gotten back to, you know, a seeming normal. But then it ends with that last jump scare, you know, right before the credits roll. And this movie just says, no, we're not going to waste our time with any of that. These are the characters. This is their story. That shotgun blast was all you needed. And then I was left staring at the blank screen afterwards. I thought that the ending was that powerful.
It kind of reminded me actually of the ending of Jaws, where you don't really, again, you expect to kind of go back to the island and see. It's been a while since I've seen Jaws, but I remember feeling like it kind of like was this abrupt ending.
So how do you feel about that? Do you like an abrupt ending, well, especially in a horror movie, or do you feel like you want closure where they show you that the characters are okay?
Well, in a horror movie, one of the things that defines a horror movie is that kind of feeling at the end, that you realize that things are horrible at the end. You know, there's no attempt to kind of like soften the blow. A lot of times the bad guy wins and survives. You know, I think a lot about like Halloween or Silence of the Lambs. Where you don't get this kind of payoff where they defeat the bad guy. So I think that that's part of why it does work as a horror movie. However, there were alternative endings. And I was going to save this for some of my what might have been, but I'll say a couple of things now. The ending of this movie was tested with audiences. And we've talked about this in other movies, about like what you said, like how it ended was perfect. That's great, but it wasn't always how it was intended originally. There were some like happy ending epilogues that were tacked onto the end, but audiences hated it and they scrapped them. So they're just, you know, they're like you, right? But like, for example, Gina Davis having the baby and then getting married to Stathis, played by John Getz. Audiences did not like that.
No.
Another alternative ending was Veronica, who that's Gina Davis's character, right?
I think so.
She has another dream of her unborn child. And this time the baby is born with beautiful butterfly wings.
Wow. That's kind of cool.
You like that? Yeah.
A little bit. Yeah.
Another alternative is Veronica gives birth to a baby, but it's actually a big maggot.
Yeah. Well, that was in the movie. It was. There's a scene where she has that sort of that dream or hallucination. I don't remember which. Where she imagines that she's giving birth, and we don't know if it's legit or not because of how fast, you know, things progressed with Goldblum. We don't know if maybe the pregnancy progressed really fast, but then she wakes up after we see this disgusting parasite. Yeah,
this is no dream in an alternative ending. It's an actual, they could have done it that way. So anyway, I think that's, it kind of shows that there are some, I wouldn't say they're concessions, but you could say that they're somewhat conceding to, okay, we're going to let the audience help us dictate what, if this is going to succeed in the end. I mean, it's really no different from like, if you write the screenplay, are you going to only ever you know, aren't you going to show it to like somebody else who knows what they're doing and try to get some feedback and possibly change based on that? Probably so. But it's interesting that that's kind of part of the process.
Some of it is just, a lot of it is studio dictated. I think about Psycho, and it was not Hitchcock's intention to end the movie with this long explanation for like, I don't know, 6 minutes about what a transvestite is, why Norman Bates is the way that he is. But the studio thought that audiences would be confused. You know, why was he dressing up like that? What's up with this guy? Mm-hmm. And so they tacked that on to the end. And in that case, I think it feels obvious that it's tacked on, because that section, oof, that kind of puts a damper on it. I mean, so, still Psycho, but come on.
So my Farley Award is when Jeff Goldblum realizes that he has his superpowers. Oh. It's very unusual way of doing this. You know, he does this, there's no music. Just like at the end where you're talking about, where there's this fog and there's this dramatic music. In this one, it's very like hyper-realism is the goal, I think. He does these gymnastics routines and Gina Davis is watching him in awe. Mm-hmm. They actually use two real gymnasts, by the way, in that scene.
Oh, you could tell.
You can't imagine that Jeff Goldblum is doing these fancy routines. But what's kind of interesting is that they were both 5'8". And Jeff Goldblum is 6'3". Mm-hmm. So if you look closely, if you rewatch it, you might find that, yeah, maybe they're a little shorter. But it was pretty convincing, I thought, still. Also, the director, David Cronenberg, had to be reminded that these gymnasts were not just like any other actor. These are really demanding physically routines. So he was doing like 12 takes, you know, and they're like exhausted and they can't keep doing this over and over again, but he's the director. He's not a coach. So that's what he did. But I thought about, we did a bonus episode on Spider-Man, Sam Raimi, and you know, he's got this dramatic music and he's like, you know, Spider-Man's climbing up the wall. And, this seemed very different from that scene.
Because
it's very like, you know, again, no music made a big impact on me.
To me, I feel like the no music thing was almost partly contributing to the idea of this almost being a religious experience.
Yeah.
You know, it's supposed to inspire awe, because to him, you know, it's kind of a love story between him and his work before he really gets into a relationship with Gina Davis. Mm-hmm. He's so into that's kind of his addiction. And so to kind of be proven right, and to find out that, oh, you know, science could lead me here to being like a higher version of myself. That's kind of what I was thinking in that scene, that it was spiritual in a sense.
Yeah, I agree. And there's this kind of, in a lot of movies like this that are asking like a what if kind of a question, there's a variety, a spectrum of how much you're expecting the audience to really believe that this could happen in real life. Or you know that it's not real, but it's an interesting sort of metaphor for something else. And this one, I thought, did a really good job of like sort of getting you to buy into it as crazy as it seemed. I think it was trying to do it and did a pretty good job of it. Gina Davis also, I thought she did a fantastic job acting throughout in this movie.
I loved her in this.
She was really great.
She's so good in it.
But when she gets excited about the, you know, when Jeff Goldblum's character first tells her about the transportation idea, she believes in it. And her acting there is really important to the rest of the movie, because since she is very, you know, she's kind of cynical about or skeptical of him, she sees through him a lot. But when she believes that there was transportation happening, I think
teleportation?
That's what I meant. I'm sorry, transportation. Teleportation happening. It kind of gives us permission to believe in it too. And it sets up a lot of the movie because of that.
Mm-hmm.
So sure. Golden takes. What's your golden take, Mike?
The practical effects are gooey and gnarly and fantastic. And like you're saying, I love the performances, but this movie works and is so much more than I think the kind of just gore fest that maybe people might remember it as, because of the writing. I think that just as much as this is a movie about a guy turning into a fly, it's also a movie about addiction. It's a movie about love. It's a movie about toxic masculinity. I watched it as a movie about sort of living with a loved one suffering from cancer or dementia and kind of watching them waste away. It's a movie about abortion. And the thing is it takes all of these themes really, really seriously. And I think that we take them seriously because the characters are so complicated. You know, you just Goldblum right off the top. He's the protagonist, but also the antagonist. And we see that especially in that final sequence that I was talking about in my best moment, where he's at the height of his villainy. You know, he's trying to drag Geena Davis into a cell basically to kill her. But he's also the love interest there, and she doesn't want to kill him, even when, you know, she has the chance, even after all of his flesh falls off and he's like this insect robot man. And then the ex-boyfriend, what is his name again? You said it before. Stathis.
He's played Stathis. By John Getz.
He's like this straight up jerk. Like, we don't like him for the whole first half of the movie. And even later when he redeems himself, we still don't like him. And that's kind of brilliant in a way, that he's like a jerk, but he actually does care for her, mm-hmm. and he shows up and he does the stuff. But most of all, I got to bring up this abortion thing at all. Because I think that the way it brings this up as kind of this serious conversation and not just this throwaway thing, you know, you feel the urgency that Geena Davis feels to get rid of this kind of alien life form that's living inside of her. And I think part of it is because Cronenberg sort of insinuates a rape idea almost, you know, because she didn't know that Goldblum was sort of transforming at the time. So it's almost like there's this idea that I didn't invite that part of you in me. And, you know, it's like an invader. Goldblum crashes into the doctor's office at one point to pull her out and stop the abortion, but he doesn't yell and scream in this scene. You know, he almost cries. He says, "Please don't kill me. The baby is, quote, all that's left of the real me." And then Geena Davis has to carry that guilt. Like, she has to live with it. But what is her choice, you know, in that scene, to give birth to a maggot baby? So back in 1986, in his review in Time magazine, Richard Corliss called The Fly a gross your eyes out horror movie that is also the year's most poignant romance. And I think that is the movie's greatest magic trick, if you want to call it that, that duality. But I'd argue that it's way more than that, because there's so much meat here if you really want to dive in and explore those other themes that I was just bringing up.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. Talking about Geena Davis, I really feel like her performance is a lot of why the movie works so well. And it's interesting, a couple of tidbits, that she was actually the girlfriend of Jeff Goldblum at the time. And she was chosen in part because she was so tall and she wouldn't look so silly standing next to him. But that kind of chemistry, I think, helps the movie, honestly.
Yeah, interesting.
And I really thought that one of the lines that raised the stakes and made it feel horrible but also believable is that line, like kind of what you're talking about, when she says, "I don't want it in my body."
Yes.
And it's like, it's really that you could tell how much that's tearing her apart. And I think that just her performance here rates among the best horror actress movies that I've seen.
And in that scene where she's saying, "I don't want it in my body," every second counts. It's not like, "We'll go tomorrow to the doctor's office." Like, no, you need to call the doctor that you know personally and have him come down to the office right now. And we need to go tonight.
We're going to do this in the middle of the night. Yeah. We're
doing it in the middle of the night because every second counts. And man, it just really works. It makes that, which could have been this throwaway, cheap kind of reference in a lesser horror movie. Like, oh, this is also a movie about abortion, but it's really not.
Yeah.
This, for that stretch of the movie, that is what the story is about. And that's what you care about.
It's central to the plot and it does a good job making it that way. Mm-hmm. So my golden take is that puppets and rubber masks, while they have their drawbacks, are superior to CGI.
Any day.
With rubber masks, yes, you lose some expressiveness. You know that it looks fake. You know, the fly's legs are like, you see them like down, and they look kind of like a joke almost.
I love them.
They don't look heavy. They look like someone has got a broom handle and is like moving these sticks. You can tell. But with CGI, it's also pretty obvious a lot of the time. You know, we watched News of the World for a bonus episode a while back, and you see this boulder rolling down the mountain and it looks CGI. You can tell. It's not like you're fooling anybody with the CGI a lot of times, but like, I will take a rubber Yoda over a CGI Yoda any day of the week. And I think The Fly works just fine as a puppet. And I'm very glad that it didn't become like a, I mean, there was no CGI in 1986, but a lot of movies to me get kind of distractingly ruined by weak CGI.
Especially horror movies. That's especially true with horror.
Could be.
Because if it's shiny, then it doesn't feel tactile anymore. It doesn't feel, if the light is reflecting off of it in a way that's not natural, then it kind of takes you out of the real world. And now we're into a video game, and that's not scary.
I know. Jurassic Park is still, to me, one of the best examples where they're using some of both, but they for sure included the puppets in there.
Yeah.
It also, this movie also reminded me, I watched Elephant Man recently, partly because I was interested in more David Lynch movies. After doing Mulholland Drive, but Elephant Man also has this sort of body horror kind of feel to it. Have you ever seen that?
Yeah.
But it's the same producer, Stuart Kornfeld did The Fly and Elephant Man, which I thought was interesting. And then this movie was also double billed with the movie Aliens, which was released the month before, which is also puppetry and, you know, horror and all that. And I think that puppetry works really well too. So
questions.
Next questions. Let's see. I'm going to ask the question that you kind of hinted at before, which is this movie about aging? You mentioned drug addiction.
Mm-hmm.
Which is what David Cronenberg
said. Addiction. I think it's many addiction. Different forms of addiction.
Addiction to a lot of things. Apparently, David Cronenberg, who gives a director's commentary on the version that I watched, and actually watched it right after because I was interested to see what he would say about it. But nice. He said a lot of people thought it was about AIDS. You know, this is 1986. So interesting, but he said he saw it as being about aging and the inevitability of death. You know, we look at the wrinkles, things changing in our bodies, and we feel helpless, powerless. And so I wondered what you thought about it. Do you feel like this movie works as a movie about aging?
Yeah. I mean, I definitely think that that's in there. Just they're able to establish Gina Davis's and Jeff Goldblum's relationship so quickly that I think if you were just looking at it from a plot point of view, you would think, you know, how are they just met. How are they really in love? I think I remember feeling that way the very first time I watched it. I look back in my log, you know, it was like 15 years ago I watched this and I was like, oh, the love story. And I dismissed the love story. And watching it this time, I couldn't believe that I did that because I did feel it so deeply. And I think it's because of what you're talking about. The idea of watching a loved one wither away in front of you, I felt that here. And I think that can go through the vehicle of, you know, cancer. I think it can go through addiction, and I think it can go through aging.
It's because you're now a mature, you know, older man, married man. So you can relate to these love stories a lot better.
I am an older man.
You become very soft in your older age.
I guess so. Well, my question is, it's also sort of focusing on the thematics. So let's stay there. The whole point, Brian, of teleportation is to skip the trip, right? To instantly reach your destination. Mm-hmm. But since the journey is so much of the point of life, the more we skip it, the more detached we get from humanity. And I think that there is this self-destructive instinct there. And we get that so many times in Goldblum's character throughout the movie. He goes into the pod before testing it because he's feeling jealous because Gina Davis is out with that other guy and he doesn't realize that she's actually breaking up with him. So he's reckless and he has something to prove. He goes in there. After Gina Davis refuses to get in the pod, he goes out and gets another girl rather than dealing with his feelings. So again, just kind of skipping over the growth stage. And too much, you know, he's too cocky to believe that anything went wrong, even as he's getting stronger and stronger, and he's not willing to face that fact until it's too late. So my question to you is, in a movie full of metaphor like this one, how aware were you when you were watching it? I mean, was this something that was on your mind the whole time? Like, oh, now the movie's about this. Oh, now I'm thinking about this. Or were you able to just kind of sit and watch it as a monster movie?
I think that it works as just sitting and watching it as an entertaining monster movie. But the the body horror element was, it felt like that was a metaphor to me. I didn't really go so far as to think of it as addiction or AIDS or aging at the time. I think it can work for all of those things, but this idea of powerlessness about, you know, what's happening to your body, it is really horrible. Actually, I thought about, you know, when I get, I haven't had poison ivy for a long time since I was like a teenager, probably, but I got it really bad a couple times, and like it, you know, go all over my arms, and it wasn't just uncomfortable. It was gross. You know, that's what it kind of felt like. And I think maybe it brought back some of those kind of memories, you know. It felt very real and visceral to me. Maybe because of that, I don't know, but.
And you don't recognize your own body, you know, when that happens, that becomes foreign. It becomes a stranger to you in a way. And how great is it that he makes this sort of museum of self in his mirror with all of, you know, his ear and his fingernails, all this disgusting stuff. But it's like, this was me at a certain point.
That's who I am, who I was. It's scary in that movie.
It's great. But I think that the fact that you can watch this as just a turn off your mind, enjoy the gore, enjoy the melodramatic music, just soak it all in, but then also think about it academically. That's what makes it great to me.
The movie actually works so well, even without the gore. I mean, I watched it without the gore in ClearPlay.
I wonder how much it cut off the gore.
Cut off. I like what you did there. Cut off. That was good.
Brutal. What might have been?
What might have been? So tell me yes or no on these actors.
Okay.
There are many people who are considered for Seth Brundle's character.
I'm going to say no to probably all of them. But
probably, yeah. Michael Keaton?
Yes. I love Michael Keaton. He could do
Michael
it.
Michael Keaton is good. He declined the role. Mel Gibson turned it down to do Lethal Weapon the next year. I love how you put these in historical context, right? This came out, Lethal Weapon came out a year after this, right? So it's like, and I think it's fun to hear that.
But you need someone with that manic energy. You need someone with the darty eyes and like.
Well, Mel Gibson had some of that in some of those early movies, I think.
I guess I think of him more as like a loose cannon. I think of these guys as they have that sort of eccentric. I could see them more as an evil scientist. I mean, a mad scientist, not an evil scientist, a mad one. But also they could play it with a little charm also. So they're not a cartoon of a mad scientist.
Yeah. There's a little bit of cartoonishness to Jeff Goldblum, I think, but again,
there's comedy here for sure.
Somehow he still makes it work. John Lithgow auditioned.
I like him, but no.
Willem Dafoe.
Same. I love Dafoe, but
even after we just saw Willem Dafoe in Spider-Man as Green Goblin, you think that he couldn't work in this role?
You're comparing Green Goblin to
a little
to,
bit
to Brundle.
A little bit in his crazy end of life sort of.
I'll say this: he could have done it. I would rather Goldblum do it.
Yeah. Final one is John Travolta.
John Travolta
comes up with every role. He could have been everything. 20th Century Fox wouldn't allow him to be cast because of the failure of his previous film for them, Two of a Kind, 1983. I have not had the pleasure of seeing Two of a Kind.
Maybe it's not a pleasure. It's
maybe
why you haven't seen it.
Might not be. I think that's it, except I will bring up that this movie was also, this was one of other attempts to create this movie. 2003, there was an attempt just a few years, this attempt to remake it. I'm sorry. An attempt to remake it in 2003. Fox Spotlight announced they were going to do it for a 2006 summer release date. It was going to be written and directed by Todd Lincoln. And he was changing it by having the first half would be like a scene for scene remake. The second half was going to be turned more into an action horror movie where Brundle would have wings and he would go on a killing spree.
Hmm.
So,
okay.
He was thinking about Billy Crudup or Brad Pitt for the role of Seth Brundle.
it's a different one. Well, Cronenberg's actually been attached to sort of reimagining or making a sequel to this for years and years. And he's basically said, I wrote a script for it. If they want to make it, I'll make it. But it doesn't sound like it's going to happen.
Interesting. There actually was a remake, I believe, or a sequel.
Yeah, there was.
Okay. So, what was I going to say? It was scratched in 2007, so it didn't actually happen. Trivia. 5 bits of trivia. Jeff Goldblum's character, right? He says he wears the same clothes every day. You remember where he said he learned it from?
Einstein,
right. Well, David Cronenberg said he does the same thing now.
Honestly, if I can get away with it, I do the same thing too. I kind of limit mine to like maybe 4 in the cycle, and I try to change them up a little bit. But
I had a teacher in high school who had like 10 pairs of the same kind of shoes.
A high fashion guy? Do you consider yourself sort of someone who cares about apparel?
I consider myself more like Einstein in a lot of ways.
Okay, that makes one of us.
Cronenberg said that, number two, Cronenberg said this movie is so depressing that it couldn't be made as a drama. Because it's horror, which got these other thrills and sci-fi fun, it works. He said the genre works because, quote, if you can have something that's even worse than your life, it's somehow comforting, unquote. That was from the director's commentary. I wonder what you thought about that. I guess that's just a quote. It's not really trivia.
But it's really interesting, though. I think that he is definitely onto something, where if this was played down the middle as a drama, still probably would have been gross, but kind of just played without the heaping side of melodrama that kind of makes it fun at the same time. Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe it would just kind of be a bummer, and maybe we'd still be talking about the metaphor and still saying that stuff was there and it was smart, but maybe it would be one of those where we say, yeah, I admire this, you know, I think I like what it's doing.
It feels,
but I don't know if it's,
feels
if
important.
It's, yeah, but maybe it wouldn't be so fun. And I need it to be fun.
Absolutely. Okay, number three, the scenes where Jeff Goldblum is walking on the ceiling as the fly, they were actually accomplished by recreating the lab that he was in on a Ferris wheel style contraption so that it could rotate. That's how they put him up there. No CGI, remember, where he could be climbing around like Gollum on some green screen.
That's cool. That's kind of like how they did it in Inception, I believe, also, where they kind of put the whole set on sort of a Ferris wheel.
The interesting thing, though, is that the lighting had to be, I mean, the lighting would change as you twist, right? So they actually had a system of mirrors to make sure that didn't mess it up. Okay, number four, the famous tagline, "Be afraid, be very afraid," originated from the dialogue, which we saw in the trailer. David Cronenberg says that he sees this pop up all the time, parodied and used, and people don't really seem to remember that it came from The Fly. I didn't know either. There's a song by Jason Isbell. You like Jason Isbell, right? I think talked about him before. But he has a song where he sings, "Be afraid, be very afraid." Seems a little odd that he's quoting The Fly there, but
influences run deep.
They do. Okay, last one. Because you know I love how long it takes to put makeup on. This is one of my favorite trivias.
There's a lot of makeup in this movie.
It took five hours to put on the makeup, and it weighed 5 pounds. So here's the thing, though. We both are great admirers of the hours. The hours.
Both is a strong term.
We love the hours. And Julianne Moore, it was said that it took 6 hours for her to put on her makeup to look old in the hours.
Wow.
So 6 hours to make Julianne Moore look old, 5 hours to make Jeff Goldblum look like a hideous fly.
That almost seems like if I was doing Julianne Moore's makeup, trying to make it look legit, like it would take me 6 hours to make her look old, like just by drawing little lines with pencils. I don't know who their makeup guy was on that movie, but step it up. I mean, 5 hours for Jeff Goldblum. He's disintegrating in this movie, and we believe it.
Or maybe it's that hard to make Julianne Moore look older and uglier, but it's pretty easy to make Jeff Goldblum look like a hideous fly. I don't know. Maybe that's what they're saying.
Maybe.
So there you go. Thank you to Chris for choosing The Fly, because I have never seen this movie before getting ready for this episode, and I'm very glad that it was chosen. So score 1 point for patrons. That's awesome. Yeah,
this was definitely one that I was glad to revisit, because in my brain, having seen it 15 years ago, I kind of filed it away under like, I get it, I don't need to see it again. Yeah. And I realized this time that I completely did not get it the first time that I
remember,
saw it.
I remember when you told me, we have our first patron, Chris, he chose The Fly. And you kind of had this eye-rolly sort of reaction from what I recall.
I never roll my eyes, Brian. I play it right down the middle. I'm a straight shooter.
Well, our next patron episode is going to be Garden State, yeah. followed by Bridge on the River Kwai. So
Fly, Garden State, and Bridge on the River Kwai. That's quite a trio.
It is.
So we want to hear from you. Have you seen The Fly? What do you think of it? Let us know and we'll read your answers on the show. You can find us at bestpicturethis.com, on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or by telling your speaker, play Best Picture This. We're also on Facebook and Twitter at Best Picture This. And for 15 years of Golden Takes, head over to Letterboxd where you'll find me, Mike Cavalieri.
So until next time, remember, become a patron. Become very a patron.
Your best one.